health and biotech news a tech bro or sis would find interesting. Today we're doing, is AI becoming too powerful? A response to the Future of Life Institute's letter asking for a pause on the development of all AI systems more powerful than GPT-4. We're doing Dr. Peter Attia, the godfather of longevity, has released the Bible of longevity, and we're going to discuss two or three big ideas from it. And we're also going to discuss, why are Americans dying so young?
How many godfathers of longevity do we have?
just you and Peter Attia.
both with Middle Eastern heritage. What's it with the Middle Eastern doctors like becoming longevity doctors?
Is he Middle Eastern?
I think so.
I guess so. Peter Attia, I think, Attia is Middle Eastern. I think it's, I think someone said he was Egyptian or something by heritage. Anyway, let's start.
Yeah, he's Egyptian, yeah.
Go on, Imran.
All right. So we had a few people ask if we could talk about this this recent letter that was published, this open letter by the likes of Yuval Noah Harari, Elon Musk, and others calling for a global moratorium, a pause on AI development. Now, the first thing to say is I'm no expert.
And when we say a few people, we actually mean one person. Continue.
Adam, why didn't you sign the letter? It would have given it a bit more weight.
When we say a few people asked for our opinion.
It was three. Yes. It was three on LinkedIn.
I had the same question on Twitter that I had like two WhatsApp messages. But I think the long and short of it from my point of view is that I'm not an expert in this space. But the context is that, you know, these artificial intelligence algorithms, these LLMs that have been released in the last few months, have for the first time created another sentient being, if I could just use that word today. For the first time in millennia, human beings can ask something other than another human any question and get like a fairly intelligent response. And the pace of development is super, super fast. So this is like a seismic event if you look at it in evolutionary terms. And I think what people are worried about is that these technologies basically escape the sandboxes that they're in, especially since there were some Twitter threads published showing how an LLM was like teaching a user how to enable the LLM to take over the user's computer by basically running some code on their local machine. So these types of threads have really got people kind of spooked if they, you know, escape, as it were, and come out into the real world and start controlling websites and devices and so on. And what would happen then? Essentially, we don't have any guarantees that AI would act in humans' best interests. So that is the context. And I think Eli Yudkowsky is one of the leaders in this field. Very interestingly, for me as a homeschooler, he's an autodidact. Doesn't have a university degree or a PhD, but he's a kind of founder of the field. He published this really strongly worded article in Time where he basically said, the threat is so extreme that we should be ready to launch missiles on the data centers of our competitor countries to basically halt or reverse the progress in this space. So yeah, that's a quick intro. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on this. Adam, surely you have a hot and bad take, so I'd love to hear from you.
So I think I heard this really interesting concept, and I think these people are falling into this trap, and it's called, do you know Pascal's Wager? Pascal's Wager is basically the argument for believing in a God is that even if there's a really small probability that God exists, you might as well believe in him, because if that probability is true, then you're on the safe side. So that's kind of Pascal's Wager.
It's like a cautionary principle.
God. Yeah. But there's also another principle that I heard from Amjad Massad, who is the founder of Replit, and he's a proponent of accelerationism in AI, which I thought was interesting here. He said that a lot of these guys, the AI doomers, are getting Pascal mugged. And what he meant by that is there's a concept of Pascal mugging, which is if Pascal was in walking down the street and someone came to him and said, I'm God, give me all your money, right? There's a slightly like a non-zero probability that that is true, right? that person is an impersonation of God or something. And if you're going to use Pascal Wager logic, you'll give him your money all the time. And that's what's happening with AI doomers, is that there's a very small non-zero probability that AI will take over and kill us all, but they're weighting that probability so highly that they're basically being mugged by that probability. And in the real world, you need to think more in a Bayesian way, where even if there's a non-zero probability of AI being as powerful as they think it will be, we can still accelerate. And then when we reach something that is close to that, then we can have that discussion at the time. Right now, it's too early to kind of...
But Adam, isn't the problem with thinking in kind of a Bayesian way that you miss out on the big black swan events, to quote one of the other OGs, Taleb, that you're unlikely to think of these big black swan events, like what they're proposing here? I mean, they're saying we need to put a pause on all AI development, which is more powerful than GPT-4 for the next 6 months, because this could be, you know, catastrophic, as in end all human life as we know it. So do you know what I mean? Like, does the Bayesian model really work in that case?
Yeah, but the idea is that there's so many different like non-zero probabilities of extinction that we can't take them all equally seriously. Otherwise, we just don't do anything and we halt all progress. So, you know, we have to take it gradually.
There's a really interesting tweet I saw from Ian Hogarth. Ian is a entrepreneur and investor in the London scene who's very well known. He posted a tweet where he said three of the pioneers of deep learning who shared the Turing Award in 2018 have substantially diverged on how they assess the risk. So even at the kind of highest, you know, level of people who understand these technologies and the threat, they have different views. So Yoshua Bengio, he signed the letter calling on an immediate pause. Jeffrey Hinton has basically said he's totally adjusted his timelines to AGI and we have to think hard how to control it. But as far as I know, hasn't signed the letter. And Yann LeCun argues that a moratorium, a pause, would do a lot more harm than good, because the question of AI alignment, which is this idea of does AI act in the best interests of humans, he says that question has been ridiculously overblown.
I think another aspect of this that is underrated is actually the importance of having a novel opinion that is viral and brings attention to yourself. I think I swear to God, like I actually think this is a big driver of a lot of this. And being right if something happens, like just having the ability to say, I signed that letter, I told you this was going to happen. You're kind of taking free money there by saying something like that, because you know nothing is going to happen. Like, you know, you're not going to stop like progress of AI, but it's like an easy money to be an AI doomer. If 10 years down the line something happens, you can say, I told you so.
Yeah. So there's a couple of interesting things here. So some people have said that, you know, we need to have a way to bring the development of AI under the kind of governance and control of like democratic societies, democratic governments. So some people have been saying, yeah, you know, we should build an alliance between countries and nations that would have shared values and goals with this technology, to make sure that in the kind of geopolitical competition between the West, in inverted commas, and its competitive states elsewhere, like China and so on, that we need to basically pool our resources and make sure we develop this in a safe way. I'm pretty sure that if you called a moratorium on AI development, you would not be able to enforce it. You wouldn't be able to make sure that countries like China or Russia or anywhere else this is being developed would actually adhere to that moratorium. So some people are saying that, you know, this would just slow us down vis-a-vis our competitors. I think the second question is, like, even if we did want to bring it under democratic control, do we have the capabilities in our
public
sector?
That's true, because like no one, the serious players in AI are all either in the UK or the US, like DeepMind, OpenAI, Facebook, all these different, they're all in the West. No one's nearly as powerful in China and Russia. I think that's overstated.
But a 6 month pause would just give them time to catch up, right? So that's basically the idea. The other point is, like, how do our like public institutions actually enforce oversight of these technologies? Like, do we actually have the talent and the capabilities and the skills in government that can actually, you know, meaningfully keep up with and regulate and measure the alignment and all of these other challenges that are emerging from these technologies? And I don't know that the answer to that is yes, because, you know, this makes me think of the Google tagline, like the Google mission or whatever it was, like, don't be evil, as it was in the early days. So these technologies sit inside two or three private enterprises, right? So I think it raises more than ever this question, like, do we actually trust OpenAI? Do we actually trust Google DeepMind, Google Brain, these AI research centers that are far surpassing any of our like university academic centers in their academic output, at least in the UK, in the case of DeepMind? Do we actually trust them to act in our best interest? Because we might actually have no alternative.
Imran, like, we're talking about this, but like to bring it back to healthcare, we're in the UK, we're still using human transcribers to transcribe like letters into like on Word documents. I think we like we're way far away from like AI taking over the world. We need like to accelerate adoption of AI and improvement of AI. As much as we can. Like right now,
my own view is not to
bring it back to healthcare.
My own view is like not to slow down. I'm not advocating that. I'm just trying to understand the perspective of people who are saying that we should slow down. And because the challenge is like if these technologies get to a point where they can develop themselves and they can accelerate their own development and catalyze their own like jailbreaking or wherever it may be, then you've got a problem, right? And one of the points that Yudkowsky makes in that letter is that when we cross that threshold, we won't know that we've crossed it until we're actually like well beyond it.
Let me add some important context that I think we've missed from this discussion, which is why people are becoming increasingly worried about GPT-4 and where it could go. Because initially you interfaced with GPT-3 through ChatGPT, which was like their online chatbot. And that was, as Imran said, sandboxed. It was its own entity. I think now they've introduced this concept of plugins where GPT can now interface with the web, basically. So it can, for example, you enter, you know, where's a good restaurant this Sunday in London, and it will book it for you, or it will do an actual action for you. And I think the concern now is becoming that, are we actually going to let it run loose on the world and start operating online? So I think that's the step at which it's become more concerning, where this is this cute thing in a sandbox where I'm asking it stupid questions, but now it's actually something that's becoming a real world actor. Like, that's the concern. And Imran, just to bring it back to the kind of health and biotech sphere, do you want to just talk as well about maybe some applications of GPT-4 in this space, or why it's interesting for us as well, beyond just the Twitter stuff?
Yeah, I think you know, in essence, like there's a lot of different ways that these models could be useful in drug development, as an example. So one is that exactly the use case Adam described in healthcare of processing huge amounts of medical record information, of like patient notes, what have you, and synthesizing them. These models can process the corpus of like published literature, which I think is growing at a rate that nobody in the world, even an army of people, could not read everything that's being published. And basically find associations or predict associations between diseases and their underlying pathways and drug candidates or classes of molecules or what have you. That's one dimension. Another dimension we've looked at, and I think we talked about this in the antibody generative AI for antibody design discussion, where in the same way that large language models are using like tokens to predict the next word or letters in a sentence, you know, antibodies are basically proteins which are made up of chains of amino acids, and you can use these models to basically predict amino acid sequence that would create a certain, you know, protein structure to create antibodies or other types of drugs that would basically have beneficial effects in various diseases. So there are lots of ways that this technology is impacting drug development. Those are a couple of examples. We're still waiting for an AI design.
I think another thing
market.
Is what we'll probably see is a proliferation of publishing from like active labs. I think like a lot of what labs do is medical writing. And if you outsource that to ChatGPT or these kind of LLM models, it's probably going to be able to 10x the best labs and the best medical writer output. And then that will lead to a proliferation of scientific papers, but then no one will be able to catch up with that. So you'll probably have you'll need ChatGPT to summarize all the information out there. So I think it'll increase output, but also make it easier to consume it, or increase input, but make it easier to consume the data as an output.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So outsource to LLMs rather than medical students.
Yeah, exactly. Probably do a better job.
Also, Imran, I wanted to get your thoughts on this point around GPT-4 and its capabilities in health, predominantly in health, but maybe biotech as well. I think it's easy, and I definitely fall into this trap of thinking of GPT or any LLM or any AI as if it's magic. But there's a clear point where it's not magic. It's not making discoveries. It's not making insights de novo out of nothing. It's being fed in. You know, I think you mentioned the quote before, like garbage in, garbage out, that applies to algorithms. So it does need some kind of data set. And I did a little bit of research into looking at who the big players are, who has good partnerships, because it feels like this LLM technology, this might be something that becomes commoditized. There'll be a few players who have this technology. And then actually the distinguishing factor might end up being who has access to large data sets from both pharma and clinical as well. So I did some research and I saw that Microsoft Azure, which is like Microsoft's cloud arm, which is partnered with OpenAI. So they already partner with Pfizer, Novartis, a lot of large insurers and providers in the US, and some large hospitals in the UK as well. Like, I wonder, you know, Pfizer and Novartis have so much data that's published in papers, but they must have 10x of that data that goes unpublished that no one has access to. Another example is AWS, Amazon. They have partnerships with Cerner, GE Healthcare, and Philips. I feel like maybe the distinguishing factor is going to be who has access to the hottest data sets. That seems to be my take on things. What do you think?
Yeah, I think at the margin of like new discovery and new insight, if you don't have the underlying data to train on, you're not going to be able to, you know, pattern recognize in those therapeutic areas, in those patient populations and so on. So I think that, you know, it's very interesting. There was an anticipated acquisition of a UK primary care EMR system called EMIS, which anybody who's worked in primary care will have probably used, by Optum in the United States. So this was one of the biggest, like, health tech, if you can call EMIS that, acquisitions, basically in living memory. It was, I think, planned at $1.2 billion. My understanding is that the acquisition has actually not gone through yet because of competition and market authority assessment, which is ongoing. But you can see the reasoning, you can see the rationale in those types of cases. I don't think EMIS as a business has any growth potential. It's a totally saturated in the UK market at 55 to 60%. It's a 150 to 200 million pound revenue business. It's taken 30 to 40 years to get there. This is not like a high growth business, which may even not be like value adding at the frontier in terms of margin to United Health or Optum's underlying business, but it's host to this enormous data set of 2/3 of the UK population's primary care records. So in light of this development, which has happened since the acquisition was announced, I think it's like another interesting example. I have no inside information. I don't know what the rationale there is, but I think you could basically tell the story, you know, $1 billion for an acquisition of 2/3 of the UK's primary care records is actually pretty good value.
I wonder if public records, like things like UK Biobank, if we're ever going to see kind of a easy to use interface where, you, like a ChatGPT like model that's trained on that, that where you can ask different questions and it just gives out answers. That would be something really cool that I think somewhere like the UK would be like on the frontier of, because we have these big biobanks that are open source.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, like a plain language way of interfacing with these data sets.
Yeah, and there's an even bigger study that's ongoing now called Our Future Health, which I think is recruiting 5 million people. And it's doing like all kinds of genetic sequencing and follow-up. So the UK actually really punches above its weight, I think, in these particular types of studies.
Absolutely. Should we move on to the longevity lifespan story?
Yeah.
Okay. So... Peter Attia, who is the godfather of longevity, has released a new book, which is the Bible of Longevity. So it goes over from start to finish how to live a longer life with better health span. And it has a lot of interesting theories on the way we practice medicine and how it could be improved or how it's wrong. Just a quick bit on Peter Attia. So he's a Stanford-trained physician. He was an oncology surgeon. And now he has probably the frontier longevity practice in the world. So I think my favorite thing about him is that he's really is like skin in the game. He's real patients. He does research. He sees how that interfaces. He really sees kind of where the rubber hits the road, rather than a lot of these people who we've talked about them, charlatans who read a paper, they do the PubMed ID and it sounds great. It showed something in rats or it showed something in monkeys, but it's not going to apply to humans. So he is, I think, the real deal. Adam, do you broadly agree with my profiling of him? Because I know you're more plugged into the longevity space.
Yeah, I think Peter Attia is great. And I agree that a lot of the people in the longevity space are PhDs or people who have who don't really interact directly with patients. And that kind of comes off when you read their writing.
I want to know is if Peter Attia is the grandfather, does that make Adam the grandson?
Nice. I'll take that.
So... I want to discuss two or three of the big ideas from the book. So the first big idea from the book is Peter Attia talks about medicine 3.0. So just for some context, medicine 2.0 is what we currently have. It's this focus on lifespan, There's a little bit of health span in it as well, but it's basically what your doctor currently does. What Peter Attia says is that medicine 3.0 is about leveling up. And instead of thinking about, you know, at the end of the life, how many disability-free years you're going to have, how many okay years you're going to have where you're free from a major ailment, let's think about human thriving, human flourishing in those years. And one of the really interesting frameworks he has, this is something he calls the centenarian Olympics, but he works backwards. So he says, instead of saying, you know, let's look at what you are today, he says, what do you want to be able to do when you're 80, 90, 100, and let's work backwards from that. So for example, if you're a 90-year-old, you want to be able to pick up your grandkids. We know that every decade you're going to lose 10% of your strength starting from 30 or 40. So if you want to be able to squat a 20 kilogram grandchild when you're 80 or 90, then today as a 30-year-old, you should be able to comfortably squat your body weight. So I think that's a really interesting approach to medicine as well. Another side of medicine 3.0 is leaning into risk. So he says in medicine 2.0, we've been too risk averse. We see the numbers, we see the clinical data, fair enough, that's medicine. But he thinks that we've been, as doctors, too risk averse, and sometimes we sacrifice human flourishing, human thriving, these kinds of bits for the sake of being too risk averse. One of the examples, in his view, is HRT in older women and the impact that can have. The last thing that he talks about is just shifting our time horizons in medicine 3.0. Currently, we look at 10-year risk profile. So if someone comes in, we look at what's your 10-year risk of having a heart attack or stroke. By that point, most of the damage has already been done. And okay, there's some things you can do, but wouldn't it be better if you started earlier? So he says we should be thinking about your 40-year risk, your 50-year risk, because instead of thinking that, you know, diabetes, pre-diabetes starts at this level, then type 2 diabetes starts at this lab value, let's think actually this is all beginning in your 20s or 30s. This is a broader metabolic symptom and this poor health, this stuff that's clogging up your arteries, it's all starting really early on. So let's treat it like that. So yeah, that's medicine 3.0. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I like the concept of looking at 20-year risk, 30-year risk, but I would even go further and say that everyone is at that risk. Like no single person is not at risk of heart disease. We're just genetically programmed to develop heart disease, metabolic dysfunction at some point. So I would even not even think about it in that way. I would just say everyone is at risk. Once you develop signs of that risk getting worse, then you need to intervene super early. One clear cut example of that is LDL cholesterol levels, which when we look at longitudinal studies, we can see that a slight increase in LDL cholesterol over a long period of time, so duration of exposure is a really important factor here, increases your risk independent of the level of LDL cholesterol. So for example, two people aged 40, one person at age 39 had a normal cholesterol level, and then 1 year later they have a high cholesterol level, and then the other person who was 40 has the same level, but it started at age 30, started going up. So the second person, the person who has a longer exposure, has a much higher risk because of the area under the curve, which is what is important here. It's the area under the curve of the increase in LDL cholesterol. And if you think of blood pressure, blood glucose levels, all of these markers that we know of general health, if we think of it the same way, we should be thinking of that like duration of exposure instead of the snapshot of the single level.
Do you think as well that we're too risk averse in the sense that we prioritize things that show up on numbers, that show up as like clinical bad outcomes, against prioritizing things that will actually help people live happier, healthier lives? I mean, a prime example that comes to my mind is sometimes when patients come into primary care, they'll be like 80, 90, and they want a medicine, say it's like a sleeping tablet, say it's like a painkiller. And you feel a bit funny about that because you're like, oh, I don't know, you know, you could take this, you could have a fall at home, it could make you drowsy and something could happen. But if you did give it to them, I think it would make their life a lot better. So there's always a bit of a tension. And I think Patia gives a point that we are maybe too risk averse currently.
The way I think about it and the way I would frame it is that we talk about personalized medicine, but we don't actually practice personalized medicine. And to me, personalized medicine is running N=1 experiments with single people and having them informed about the risks. So the way I would do it is if one single person wants to run an experiment that has risks and they understand those risks, your role as a physician is to help them do that and minimize harm, but also help them measure the effect of that experiment. So a good example would be, for example, blood pressure. We know that ideal blood pressure, systolic blood pressure, is probably around 110, even lower in some cases. But most physicians would be comfortable keeping people at around 130 or less systolic blood pressure. Why? Because any intervention might increase the risk of, as you said, hypertension or side effects. But if the patient knows about that, we can do small experiments and measure the side effects and then adjust accordingly. And I think that's real personalized medicine that we should be advocating. The problem is that it takes that's resource intensive, and most physicians don't have the time to run these kind of N=1 experiments.
That's super interesting, the N=1 stuff. Hmm. Imran, do you have any thoughts on this, or should we move on to the next point?
One thought that does often cross my mind is the added burden of anxiety about health status with our improved understanding of preventative measures and the type of thinking that Adam described, which is actually thinking about your cardiovascular risk a few decades earlier than you might otherwise. What's the price we pay for that? So I like to think about those things. I talk about them with my wife, who's an NHS GP, a primary care physician. And her instinct is do the things that you know that will benefit you, like with your diet, with your exercise, with your sleep, and try not to worry too much about your health status, because some of those things, although they are modifiable or measurable, the likelihood is that in most cases, if you were to measure them, they wouldn't be in a range that you would have to treat them for now. And it's just adding to your concern, your anxiety about your health status and your health behaviors. So that's the kind of conversation we have in the household. She's still a practicing physician, maybe very much steeped in the thinking of the cost-constrained and resource-constrained NHS. But I do think that that's one thing we'll have to deal with at large if we start to bring earlier prognostication and diagnosis into the population.
So I have two comments on that. First, so I think the correct way of doing it is to encourage people to outsource that worry and that anxiety to their primary care physician. And I think that's where innovation and health tech tools come into play. So that's something that we did, for example, at Span, is the idea with my previous startup was that we would aggregate all the health data from all your wearables, and you don't even have to worry about it. You don't have to track it yourself. We just give you the pure insights and suggestions, and we measure the impact. I think that's what a really good primary care service mm-hmm. should do. You should go in, do your tests, and then you receive a plan, take this pill, do this, and we'll worry about, and you can kind of select the level of insight or anxiety that you want to be, that you want to get. Because if you're a super anxious person, you don't want to know, just let me know what to take and what to do, and I'll do it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to know about my numbers, then that's fine. But if you want to know all the numbers and all the curves and all of that, we can also provide you with that. So I think there's a lot of individualization there, but it's also, I like this concept of outsourcing the anxiety to someone, to data freaks like us. Because I want to know more. I'm not content with just knowing what we can know. I want to know everything. And I want to know, even if there's a tiny risk, I kind of thrive on that, and I want to know more. It doesn't affect me negatively. But I've dealt with people who suffer from what's called health anxiety, and it's a real thing. You can have real anxiety caused by this is a bit of a hidden secret of longevity and private practice, is that a lot of it is, I won't say exploiting, but kind of playing into people who have health anxiety, and there's a bit less emphasis on, maybe you don't need to know this information. You don't need to do an MRI, a whole body MRI scan every year. But if people are paying for it, they're going to find someone who will lean into that and do it. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of individualization. I need to kind of assess the patient's need and how, if it's going to be a net negative knowing all of this stuff.
So the second big idea from Atiyah's book is the way we think of evidence is wrong. And I think over the past few years, we've seen this science with a capital S, aka the religion of science, when people say science says this or science says that. And you always know if someone says that, it's not true, because that's not how it works. But the point he makes is that when we're thinking about longevity, and I'm not talking about the quacky stuff about living to 500 in a computer interface. I'm talking about really, you know, realistic goals like living to 100 in good health and having like a nice, dignified, quick death, which is, I think, what most people actually want. He talks about that in this like religion of science, we've been using the gold standard randomized controlled trial, which is really basically you want to know if a drug or something works. You take a group of people, you split them into half randomly and give one side the drug and the other side basically nothing, and you see the impact. And that has been our gold standard in the medical complex. Now, obviously in longevity, this doesn't work. So how can you redesign a randomized controlled trial which looks at, hey, we gave this drug to 20-year-olds and that prevented them having a bad outcome when they're 90? Like 70-year-long randomized controlled trials of good quality don't really exist. So essentially he just says, okay, you know, let's just take a step back. Longevity has a bad name because of people who quote like mice trials, but we do need to look at other forms of evidence. We need to look at observational studies. We need to look at also not just mice studies and rodent studies, but if there's something consistently showing effect in both rodents, in non-human primates, in all of these things, and it's consistently showing that effect, let's just pay attention to it. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that in terms of just shifting our view of evidence and capital S science.
My view is that here, this is another use case of N=1 experiments, where if you can demonstrate improvement in a certain marker, even if you're using something that is more experimental or not proven in randomized controlled trials, if you're using it in one person in a methodological way and you're showing an improvement in a health marker, then that justifies the use of this intervention. But I think this is a broader problem of, maybe Imran, you want to comment on this, of kind of pharmacological research in general. So one example here, one pioneer in this is like the TAME trial that is proposing to measure the effects of metformin on aging. So I think there needs to be more funding and more research that looks at age-related disease onset as a primary endpoint. And the problem is there's just not enough interest and not enough funding to fund these big trials.
Let me add in. So what you're saying is with the TAME trial that's looking at using metformin, a common diabetes drug, and seeing its effects on aging. Can we slow aging down, basically? I think what the interesting thing near Barzilai has done is, like I gave the example of, you know, running a randomized controlled trial where you give it to people in their 40s and 50s and you track them until they're 90. That's a 40-year study. Unrealistic, too expensive. What he's done is he set like a surrogate marker. So he said, let's look at when these people first develop their first major illness. And that is something that will happen in the next 5 or 10 years, probably in this group. So there are interesting ways in which you can set surrogate markers.
Yeah, that's actually the main innovation of the TAME study. I think metformin, I don't think is that big of a longevity drug. And I don't think the TAME study will show huge impact. But the main innovation is that they got the NIH to approve that surrogate endpoint. And that was really important. And I think we need bigger and larger studies to look at that endpoint with different interventions. And that needs to be, I mean, even if we had a fraction of the funding we have for cancer drugs, looking at cancer endpoints, going into mm-hmm. that endpoint, we'll have a revolution in longevity treatments.
Adam, you posed the question to me a moment ago. Like, I don't have the answer, but I can see that there are lots of different approaches. So I do think that, you know, this N=1 approach is a really relevant one, which actually I think would be quite resource intensive. And I think that's the problem in many healthcare systems is you can't actually deliver healthcare like that. In addition to that, you have people working on digital twin technology, where they're trying to basically get to a point where we can model physiology in silico, so you can begin to understand across multiple different parameters, you know, before you've even dosed someone, what the impact of a certain drug would be, because, you know, you've gathered enough data on their physiology or on lots of people's physiology. So you have these type of in silico potential research methods which are emerging. And then you also, in the kind of biological domain, you have people looking at, you know, I've often joked it's a great time to be a mouse because of all these studies that are showing like longevity in mice. But you have like other approaches where people are using like human cells in organoids, which are much more sophisticated than single cell cultures, where you basically create like a miniature version of like cardiac tissue or bone marrow or vascular tissue. And you may actually create like a miniature organ, which has multiple different structures inside it. And that becomes your
system.
That's
great for drug discovery. But the problem is that we're going into phase three trials that are looking at endpoints that are not, that I think are the wrong endpoints in many cases. We should be looking at the tame endpoints more often.
Okay, what would be some examples? Give us some examples of endpoints. Like, are you talking about like vascular elasticity and things like that?
No, so the endpoint of tame was onset of any one of the major age-related diseases. So that was the endpoint that they proposed in TAME. Whereas most trials are looking at, you know, very specific diseases or very specific endpoints related to a single disease.
Okay.
So I think there needs to be a shift because, as you said, and I agree with Peter Attia, is that we won't have randomized controlled trials looking at a lot of these longevity markers because it's just not practical. But I think there is a way around it if we shift, proportion of research into tame endpoints.
Okay, so Imran, let me get your public health lens on this question. So this isn't Peter Attia's point, but this is something I've come across when we're talking about proactive screening, proactive treatment, getting into stuff really early when maybe there's not a real problem to be treated yet. And the framing is that sometimes in medicine, we think on a population-based level, we are looking at studies which have been done on a cross-section of the population, and they're meant to be applied to millions of people. And Adam's been mentioning this point of shifting our lens to more of the individual frame, the N equals one, what can we personally do for this person? And I think the really interesting concept I've come across in longevity is about this long tail of medicine. So let me give you an example, which is that we will joke about people having whole body MRI scans every year, which is clearly, a bit ridiculous. And on a population level, that doesn't make sense. You're going to pick up thousands of incidental findings, and it's not going to be hugely beneficial. But on the individual level, and thinking about the long tail of medicine, so thinking about those really unlikely outcomes, it is possible that you will pick up a cancer really early and they will get some treatment for it. So my point, I guess, is that do we sometimes miss or think too much about the forest rather than the trees? And are we missing this long tail of medicine where if we looked at someone as an individual, in a personalized approach, that we would be a bit more proactive and on these kinds of things?
So I think the issue, the reason why you have this clash of paradigms is that public health, like the clue is in the name, right? So these are people whose task is principally to like make resource allocation decisions and policy decisions at population level. So that's why you get these competing interests where like, you know, where does your next incremental dollar go? Does it go in like maternal mortality, or does it go on MRI screening, or does it go on statins in the water supply? So that paradigm, I think, will always be concerned with that population level intervention where they're having to think about the impacts on the forest. And when you have, you know, at the other end of the extreme, where you have people who have the luxury of being able to deal with N equals one type of encounters, I think that's just a very different, it's a very different world. And the decision making and the benefactor and the amount of resource that's available and the kind of specialization of the treatment to the individual is just a totally different proposition. So I think that's why you see this this conflict. And I think a lot of like people, when they hear people on the internet talk about, oh, I had this whole body MRI and I found this thing on my kidney and blah, 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 like, you know, everybody should have access to this, is that they're committing that kind of logical fallacy there, where they're looking at what's possible for them as an individual in their circumstances, and they're kind of equating that with what should be done at a policy level, you know, for a whole population of trees. So I think there's also a health economics argument here
to say that, you know, that money that you're going to spend on a whole body MRI, you're probably more likely to find something more significant if you just do like a full blood panel every year.
Yeah, but the reason that the health economic argument is even like made is because that resource that everybody in the population would have a claim for when it comes to public budgets. But when it comes to the individual, I mean, this is like discretionary spending, whether you spend your incremental dollar on a Kit Kat, a pack of cigarettes, or an MRI, like it's kind of up to you.
All equally useful.
Another good example here is colonoscopies. So bowel cancer or colon cancer.
Are you an
is
advocate of colonoscopies, Adam?
I am. But the problem is, so bowel cancer or colon cancer is completely preventable because they start at small as small polyps, and then you can remove those if detected early. That's why colonoscopies are recommended at certain ages. But a more health, economic, efficient way of doing it is doing stool analysis. Right now, I think in the UK, at ages above is it 65, or maybe 45, you're entitled to a colonoscopy every 10 years, but then you can do a fecal occult blood test every year. So you're probably missing a few people there with this approach. But on a population level, it makes sense because you need to take the economics into consideration. But if someone has unlimited resources and low health anxiety, I would recommend that they do just get a colonoscopy every year.
Adam, what is your preferred minimum number of annual colonoscopies?
I think... I mean, speaking to expert gastroenterologists, they all say that every year is a bit overkill. So maybe every few years you get a colonoscopy.
The last point on Peter Attia's book is about emotional health and longevity. And I think this is an area overlooked by a lot of the bros who are into longevity, rightly or wrongly so. But it's quite cool. So Peter Attia's therapist is Esther Perel, who's also like the godfather of therapy and relationship counseling and stuff. So it's quite cool how these two big players in the space kind of counsel each other as well, which is quite interesting. The godmother, and she asked Peter Attia, what's the point of living for so long if you're utterly miserable? Just some quick context. Peter Attia is incredibly successful, incredible workaholic, but he was at a point where he was just totally detached and totally miserable. He talks about a scenario in which he's in New York working and he gets a call from his wife to say that their, I think, 5-year-old kid has had a cardiac arrest. And he says, okay, ring me when you're in ITU and I'll speak to the doctors, and carries on working in New York. So he was in the stage of life where he was just totally kind of devoted to his work, but perhaps lacking on the emotional side of things. And then he ended up going into kind of a mental health retreat and working on that side of things. But I think my broad question to both of you is, in terms of longevity, and Adam, I don't know if you do this in your longevity practice, is there any appreciation? And I want to separate, actually. So there's mental health, but let's talk about emotional health. Is there any work towards that in your longevity practice, or is there any things that you recommend doing?
Yeah, I think it's a huge aspect. And I always say there's like five aspects, or like there's five kind of cornerstones of longevity. There's when it comes to lifestyle, there's sleep, exercise, nutrition, avoidance of harm, and then there's the emotional health. And they're very much interconnected. My focus is more on the first four, because they play into emotional health and it's not my area of expertise, but we do work with people who are experts on emotional health and mental health well-being, and I think it's definitely really important.
I mean, there's a lot of research on your point about emotional health and longevity that shows that the most successful citizens in their longevity, one of the kind of cardinal characteristics is the quality and number of their relationships, their intimate relationships. There's a very good study that we can link below, and there's a short news article about this from Harvard, which basically found, it's a really good predictor of survival, of longevity and of health span, is the quality and quantity of your relationships. And I do think that...
So is there a positive correlation between quantity of relationships and longevity? Or is it the...
No, like, so...
The other way.
Let me actually pull the study up. So the study is called the Harvard Study of Adult Development. It's basically a very long-term... I think it's like a cohort study which started in 1938. So it's one of those, you know, ones that... I don't know if we'll be kicking off studies like this very often anymore. But basically followed 724 participants. 270 of them were from Harvard University and 450 or so from Boston at large. And then they now follow up the descendants of these people. And they basically found... that one of the key conclusions is that good relationships are key to physical and mental well-being. So it is interesting because I do think that you can get sucked into some of the aspects of like health and well-being culture, which, you know, whether it's like gym culture, which has a kind of dark side in terms of like body image and body consciousness, or you know, optimizing to the nth degree for technology. And you can have this as a blind spot, I think, as you pointed out, Adam. And I also think, you know, just recent changes in terms of COVID, remote work, and just the atomization of society and families and so on makes it harder for people to feel embedded in like a fabric of relationships.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also it's more, you're more likely to be kind of active, you're more likely to be healthy if you're doing this with other people who have the same lifestyle. So you can't really kind of look at one aspect of the, of health without the other.
So they say here in the study that they started to look back at their people who were happy and healthy at the age of 80, and they wanted to see what was it that would predict their happiness and well-being at that age. And they thought it would be cholesterol level or blood pressure at the age of 50 that would be the best predictor, and it wasn't. It was satisfaction in your relationships, particularly in your marriage, that was the best predictor of a happy and healthy life.
Okay, so let's finish off with this story, which is about why Americans across every social or economic class are living much shorter than their counterparts in equivalent countries like the UK. Imran, do you want to talk through this Twitter thread or this article posted by John Murdoch?
Yeah, we can throw this up on the screen. Basically, John Byrne Murdoch is one of the columnists or editors at the Financial Times. He basically presented some data that shows that, contrary to the American dream, this might be the American nightmare, which is that if you look at life expectancy by economic status, so if you plot on an x-axis where people are from the bottom 1% of economic well-being right to the top 1%, and then their life expectancy on the y-axis, you see people in the United States, even at the high end of wealth, they have a shorter life expectancy than people in England. And I think this is interesting because the curves have a similar shape, where at the lower end of income distribution, people have the shortest life expectancy. That's not that surprising. But if you told me that with the amount of money that's being spent in the US, the maturity of their like provider systems, the hospitals and so on, that even at the high end, on average, in terms of income distribution and life expectancy, you would see the England sitting above the US, I would be very, very surprised by that. But that's what this data seems to show.
Yeah, and I think, Imran, one of the common myths perpetuated, it seemed, was that, okay, although Americans don't have a socialized healthcare system, at least the people in the upper echelons, the rich people, they have access to all these amazing tertiary services and all these world-leading experts. So at least
longevity doctors.
Yeah, exactly. That was my impression. But this shows that that's not the case. Even the rich people there are living a shorter lifespan.
Yeah, and we can dig into this just a little bit more. So if you look at any specific income level, you basically see approximately a 5-year gap in life expectancy between England and the US. And the average American has the same life expectancy as somebody in Blackpool. Now, Blackpool is cited as an example of like a relatively low income city in the UK with a largely white population. And a lot of the losses in life expectancy in many developed nations have been, my understanding is amongst, when you split by socioeconomic group, is amongst like white poor citizens. So the average US citizen is basically living a Blackpool life expectancy. If you adjust for COVID and you remove COVID deaths from this data, you also see a decrease in life expectancy in the US, whereas in most other developed nations, you see either a continuing increase or a bit of a kind of tailing off.
So what were the major drivers of this disparity?
Yeah, so my understanding is that the concentration of this risk of increased death is actually below the age of 40. So a lot of this excess death is happening and the loss in life expectancy is actually greater when you lose somebody who's younger because of the number of years that person would be expected to live, which have then been, you know, erased. So below the age of 40, you have more of what they call these deaths of despair. These are deaths which are driven by largely like social and environmental factors, like gun deaths, gunshot wounds, you've got road traffic accidents, you've got suicides and things like that. And I think one of the conclusions that they've come to here is that the US, although it has this kind of like really strong like upper end of like healthcare resources and facilities for people who can pay for them, because the society is such an individualistic society, the safety net is much looser, it's much weaker. So many more people find themselves falling through the cracks, whether it's in terms of their metabolic health and obesity and living in a food desert and having access to the education and resources to get well, violence, drugs, road deaths, and so on. So I think that's basically one of the things that they could kind of conclude, which is that this is about the trade-off between personal freedoms and the decisions that a society chooses to make versus the quality of the healthcare system. So unfortunately, we've talked about the US healthcare system a lot on this podcast about, as you know, a destination for healthcare startups, as a place for physicians to work if they're struggling with aspects of working in the UK. But it's important to understand that, you know, part of the appeal for founders to solve problems in the US is that the US has so many problems and there's such large scale problems that these opportunities emerge for companies to basically address them. You know, make of that what you will, whether that's good news or bad news. I think it's obviously a mixed picture.
Okay, so let's finish off by quickly doing some audience feedback. So Abdul Mahmood, he's an OG doctor and ex-PM at Google, now building something very interesting. He said, this format needs to be a way more regular occurrence. It's like a better version of the all-in pod. I think that's the nicest compliment I've heard.
Nice.
And then Enki Bumbu on YouTube said, great channel, huge potential, no BS. That was really nice as well, I thought. I think that's what we've been going for.
We're getting more positive feedback. That's a good sign.
I know, no haters this time. So I kind of enjoyed the hate comments, I'm not going to lie.
We must be doing something wrong.
Yeah, give us more hate, guys. Come on. You can do better than that.
I think it's Adam, because...
Adam, you should chill something and then they'll come out in droves. What's your latest supplement?
No, I think actually it was because Adam was in a good mood last episode and he wasn't as contrarian or as disagreeable. You were quite docile. You were a bit like trunked, I think, like a bit trunkalized. I don't know what happened. Maybe you had a good day. Okay. All right, guys. I'll see you next time. I'll stop recording.
All right.
Cheers. Cool.